atmosphere where the general public is encouraged to assume the worst about judges, and how should we be responding? There has been a shift of control in the courts, and there has in the past been pushback against prior shifts and effort to impeach Earl Warren. On the other hand, it's my sense that even Earl Warren did not have protesters outside of his house, and that he and other members of the court were able to lead a normal life. And so many of us have been watching this with a sort of disbelief. How did we get to this place where the discourse has become so debased and kind of gross, and what can we do about it? What should any of us be doing to try to protect public confidence in the rule of law? I am really, really excited to have Megan McArdle with us tonight to guide the conversation through the panel and the fireside chat. Megan is a columnist for The Washington Post, as you all should know. She previously wrote for The Economist, The Atlantic, and Newsweek. Her columns are themselves a lovely respite from hardened team discourse and offer an unexpected angle that's not easily pigeonholed, so if you are not reading them, you should. I will turn this over to Megan to begin the panel conversation. Megan, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'd like to thank our great panel here. We have Jay Edelson, Nicole Garnett, and James Burnham, and we are going to be talking tonight about attacks on the court, whether we're facing a legitimacy crisis, which, look, I am not a lawyer, I should say. I think probably the only person in this room is not a lawyer. And so I look at this from the outside, and what I see is a will to undermine the courts without necessarily thinking through what happens after that. And so that's the problem we're gonna try to get at. And we're gonna start just by asking, are we risking a crisis of legitimacy on the courts? And if so, how did we get here?
So yeah, I mean, I can go first. So I think the answer is that it's a totally manufactured crisis of legitimacy, and one that we've never seen something like this in my lifetime. It's an incredibly well-funded, well-planned attack on the Supreme Court as an institution, with all different facets, from social media to advertising to paid protesters to everything, to attack and undermine the justices for everything they've done and things they haven't done. And I think it's important to keep in mind that this is not an institution that is designed to withstand this sort of sustained political attack. Each justice, other than the Chief Justice, only has 3 permanent staff. And none of them are communications experts. None of them are campaign consultants. These are not political people. You know, Justice Barrett was a law professor. Justice Gorsuch was an appellate court judge. It is not an institution that was built to be under sustained political attack year after year to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars. And so that is something that I find extraordinary and unbelievably dangerous. And we can talk more about the specifics, but I don't think people fully have reckoned with how dangerous what they are doing is, because as soon as the court's ability to enforce the law and to be respected as the final expositor of the law is gone, the instability that we're going to have at the federal level, at the state level, and even potentially in private disputes is almost impossible to overstate. And I think that's very bad and quite dangerous.
Well, so we're going to talk more in a minute about what the consequences are, but let me try to offer the argument from the people I know who welcome the attacks on the court and see them as just. And their argument would be, yes, it's true, justices didn't used to be political people, but now they are. This court is an unprecedented political actor in a way that was not true in previous years, and they are undermining themselves. It's not that we are doing something to them, it is that they have done it.
So I would say that that's just nonsense. I mean, look, think about the Warren Court. There's a funny story that Eugene Volokh, who many of us like, had a fake cert pool petition about Gideon versus Wainwright. And it was the question about whether a person had the right to paid counsel as a criminal defendant. And the cert petition, the fake petition pool said something like, some kind of half-baked substantive due process claim, splitless, meritless, fact-bound deny. If you clerks on the court, that was funny, but maybe you don't. But in the end, I thought it was funny. Anyway, this court is so much less political It's not making stuff up. It's just applying a formalist procedural rules that is resulting in people that don't, the results of people don't like it. And I think that's fine. There's a big difference between deciding that we don't like the outcome of decision X and saying the court is illegitimate. I literally think this is like the most seriously principled court that we've seen in many years. This is not a court that's trying to make political decisions. It's actually a court that's trying to just apply rules that come up with outcomes. And sometimes the court will, the justices will like it, and sometimes they won't.
Well, let me try to summon my inner court critic again and ask, okay, maybe that's true. Maybe they are just applying rules. I think there are, I am not a lawyer, and I am not gonna try to argue with a law professor about whether this is true. But, you know, the court is more ideological than it was. Right,
no,
I mean, I
know
that.
It's not more ideological, it's less ideological. They're just applying rules. Earl Warren is far more ideological than Amy Barrett.
Well, I guess I would say this, and again, I'm now summoning my incredibly weak command of famous cases, but when I look at a case like Roe or like Becky, they are obviously less rule-bound, right? They're sort of summoned from the inner emotional state of the judge writing them, I guess is the best way to put it.
They're just made up.
summoned from the inner emotional state. That's a little, you know, there's more kind of room to try to compromise with how the public feels and feel out how elites think about this and come up with a kind of rough compromise that keeps the peace in a way that when you are applying a hard rule consistently, you might be more consistent, but you are also actually less able to keep this from tripping into political controversies.
Do you think that's an accurate description of Roe versus Wade?
So I don't understand. I literally.
Emanations and penumbras.
So why is it that, no, go ahead.
So you know, Jay, I want to bring you in.
Yeah, that's okay. So I come at this from, please, I don't want any tomatoes or booze yet. center left position. Someone who liked a lot of the kind of policy judgments that were underlying some of the older Supreme Court cases. I do view there to be kind of a unique crisis. I don't think that it's unprecedented. I think really what makes it unique, so there's always been attacks on the court. Back Thomas Jefferson, you know, let's impeach this person.
Impeach Earl Warren, right?
Yeah, the court packing of FDR.
Yeah.
I think somewhat outlandish attacks during the nomination process. I mentioned Thomas, and I think you said it started with, Bork. But in my mind, you know, that's when I was conscious during Thomas, and so that's where my history starts.
That's, we were both in college.
Yes, yes, so I was actually awake at that point. And I only learned recently that you can actually read books and find out what happened before. So that's been helpful. I think partly what's unique is that we're in a soundbite era. So it's very easy to say this vice presidential candidate is weird. And then that gets put on Twitter and TikTok and just repeated, and that's what people hear. In terms of whether this court is more kind of rule-bound than the Warren Court or other courts, my view is it depends on who you ask. You know, as someone who is pro-choice, yes, Roe v. Wade is thin the word. You know, I've only gotten part of the way through the Constitution. I'm not yet at the part where they talk about trimesters.
It's at the end.
It's at the end. Footnote. Yeah. But I know it's coming, and I'm excited for that. I understand that, and I also understand people saying, well, we've really liked having this right, and when it's taken away from us, that feels like activism. And both sides can accuse each other of activism. What I agree with everybody else is there's something different going on It's not just at the Supreme Court level, but of kind of these personal attacks, shouting down when Judge Ho goes and speaks at a law school, whether you agree with him or not, what an opportunity to listen to him and speak to him. And, you know, the extreme, what I view as kind of the extreme woke left, doesn't believe in that anymore. It's just, let's shout everybody down and let's put social pressure. And that's what changed, and that is not a good thing for our democracy.
It's interesting that you talk about social media, because I think that has to be a big part of it, right? I remember, so I was kind of a lefty in college for a bit, and I used to go to protests, and because I went to school in Philadelphia, it's a large media market centered on a pretty small city. And so the great part was, you could go to a protest, and then if you ran home, you could watch yourself on television.
Oh.
And I remember going to a pro-choice protest where I think there were like 20 people in the march, but they had filmed it because it was a slow news day. They'd filmed it so that it looked like there were hundreds of women converging on downtown Philadelphia. And I think that's part of it, right? Is I know about all of these controversies. I know about all of these shouting downs that I would not know about if it were 20 years ago. I wouldn't know who Judge Ho was, probably. I'm sure that's bad. Apologies, but I don't normally write about the law, and that the fact that you can go viral, but also get the idea from other people who are going viral, does that, you know, would this? I take the point that it goes back to Bork, that this is, that there is a long and incredibly poisonous game of tit for tat that has now been going on for 30, 40 years. But would it have been so bad if it weren't for the internet? Is this something that has given people tools to undermine the court in a way that was not possible before?
So just to be clear, I don't think there's been a tit for tat, or it's been a lot of tats, because the people in this room have never tried to destroy the life of a nominee to the Supreme Court from the other party. That has never happened. It has not happened before Kavanaugh. It has not happened after Kavanaugh. Do I think the internet facilitates it? Sure. But I think, and actually a much bigger culprit of it, is what people commonly describe or call the mainstream media. And the idea that the New York Times or the Washington Post will take seriously the most ludicrous, unsubstantiated, ridiculous allegations in the world. And I don't just mean Ford. I mean Julie Swetnick, the one who said that Brett Kavanaugh was wearing his Georgetown prep uniform, dumping Quaaludes into a punch bowl somewhere in Maryland sometime in the 80s. Which was treated as a serious allegation. Every Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, including Kamala Harris, signed a letter that he should withdraw in light of the Swetnick allegations. That was treated as a serious story. That is different. I don't think when Justice Thomas went through his process, it was this bad. It was certainly not this bad when I was a high school kid. It is a new thing. It's a big problem. And maybe that's reinforced by the internet and sort of the feedback loop that reporters live in, where they sort of read their followers. But I think the total abandonment of journalistic neutrality at sort of mainstream institutions is a huge culprit.
So as a Thomas clerk, I think what Justice Thomas went through and the nominee was awful. So I'm going to put that out there.
I agree.
It was terrible. So I think there's a couple of things going on here. The first is, you know, the fear of saying, maybe even entering this process. We want people who are really highly qualified, like some of the people in this room. I'm looking at you, Greg Cassis, to agree to go through this process, right?
Greg doesn't even know what a Quaalude is.
We really want good people to agree to go through this process, and the situation in the confirmation it's a chilling effect on people deciding to do this. It's awful. And then a second thing I will say is, even if you get confirmed, it's still awful. I mean, people are trying to kill the justices. I'm sorry. I mean, maybe it's gotten better, but you know, we have folks, you know, protesting outside of the justices' houses day on day, and having to drive your children to school in armored cars. It is just a terrible situation. It's not just the confirmation process, which, as James points out, is bad, but it really has become this actual life and death situation that I don't think we should dismiss lightly.
I think the question is, though, how does the confirmation process start setting up the later arguments? Because if you can kill someone's credibility, you make them into some just lunatic fringe person, then as the time goes by, it's easier for a lot of people to say, oh, they're just making political decisions. And I don't want to say that that is a strategy by the Democrats, because what binds the Democratic Party is that we have no strategy at all. But that is I think what happens where, and it, James, I agree with you that the attacks on conservative nominees are different than the attacks on liberal or moderate nominees. It's not something I'd focus on before, and that's not a good thing. And your Democrats are going to say, but how about Merrick Garland? You know, I'm just saying, we can go back and forth the whole time. To me, the only way to solve this is by thinking about, what if the people who don't align with me control the Supreme Court? What do I want the rules to be? Now, the people who are aligned with me control the Supreme Court. What do I want the rules to be? And what everyone ought to, in a constitutional democracy, should agree with is, look, ever since Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court is the last decider. And if they're not going to be seen as credible, then who's going to be the decider?
So we'll get to consequences later, I guess. Sorry. We got an order here, people. You guys are being too interesting and rushing ahead. So let me haul back and ask, you know, we've already heard some, right? We've heard the Thomas case. Let me name some of the cases that, to me as an outsider, seem like the big cases. And I want to talk about the relative importance and the relative effects of those cases. So one is obviously the ethics investigations that you've seen from ProPublica. One was the Kavanaugh hearing. And I was really struck, even for me, I was one of two vaguely right-leaning columnists who was kind of in the middle. It is impossible to know whether this happened or not, right? All of the details are bad. I completely agree with you, by the way, that I was one of the people who, I wrote a column actually criticizing the New Yorker quite heavily. I thought that the second accusation was irresponsible. It was very clear from what you, if you know anything about kind of how testimony and eyewitness testimony and memory works, that just from her own account, that by the time she had memories, there was a good chance her memories were confabulated. She had been talking to people about it for months. She didn't initially know whether it had been him. And I think, you know, it can be totally sincere. Confabulation of memories is not something that people do deliberately to be bad people. It can be a very sincere thing. I once convinced my sister as an experiment that Mickey Mouse had punched me at Disney World, and I got her to remember it, and we never went to Disney World because my parents don't love me.
Were you ever punched by Mickey Mouse?
No, I have never been. I've never been to Disney World, never been punched by Mickey Mouse. And so, you know, I thought that they should not have printed that, and I thought that the Julie Swetnick accusations were obviously ludicrous and should... I mean, look, if you have photographs, fine, but that should not have gone into a media report unless you had better corroboration than a random person who says that she saw him waiting in line. But that said, right, what I was surprised about was how radicalizing that was for so many people I knew, who that was the moment at which they started getting angry at me for voting for Kamala Harris, which I am, please don't throw tomatoes.
We're going to persuade you otherwise in the next hour.
Good luck with that. But I saw people just lose it in a way that I had not seen it before. They were so angry about what happened to Brett Kavanaugh, precisely because it was a character attack, precisely because there's no way to refute it. This thing that happened 35 years ago, I remember it. You know, how do I prove that didn't happen, that an unidentified thing at a time when I was 16 years old didn't happen? There is no way. And it terrified people that this is the future of the court. And I think we have it. The good news is we have not seen that since. But that, to me, stands out as potentially the worst. But there are other candidates. There's the Thomas hearing. There is the incredible interest in Mrs. Alito's flag choice. And which of these attacks, and there is the violence, Which of these attacks are the most dangerous, in your opinion?
So
I'm going to ask each of you to say. And what are the consequences of that?
I mean, it's hard to pick a worst one. I mean, I was there for the Kavanaugh process. I was back to the White House and worked on the confirmation. And I think part of why it was so radicalizing is, I mean, for those who know Justice Kavanaugh, he is about the most mild-mannered, nice, upstanding, least likely guy to be caught up in a quaalude ring of pretty much anybody I know. And so it really demonstrated that they can make up anything about anyone and have it treated as though it is credible, and have people who are engaged in motivated reasoning immediately adopt it and call you a rapist for the rest of your life because somebody that you may or may not have ever met in high school, because by the way, there's not any evidence that they actually met. There's some evidence that they were in the same city at the same time, probably, can come up out of nowhere and make this accusation. And by the way, when it happened, you know, Ford sent her letter to Dianne Feinstein, who to her credit recognized that this was not a legitimate allegation. She sat on the letter. The letter came in over the summer. The BI process doesn't even go back before age 18 because there's long been a recognition that stuff in high school, absent extraordinary circumstances, is not relevant to whether you can serve as a federal judge. And she pocketed it. Now, it got around to other staffers on the committee. I forget which senator staffers. Other people know. It's probably been reported. Who then put it out to the press, first through The Intercept and then through Emma Brown at The Washington Post. And then, you know, everyone knows what happened after that. I think that's unbelievably dangerous because you have now convinced, through basically no evidence, half the country that Brett Kavanaugh is a rapist. There's a direct through line from that process to a man with a gun coming into his backyard to try to kill him and maybe his family, which happened. And, you know, but for the grace of God, that could have been a true national catastrophe and a personal catastrophe for him. The stuff with Justice Alito's wife is also horrible. This is a private person who was hanging a flag, upside down flag, or the flag with the tree that no one had ever heard of until it became a January 6th symbol in the New York Times. You know, that's really bad stuff because it convinces the crazy people out there that these are evil people. And that's the kind of thing that gets people killed.
Nicole, you have a lot of thoughts on this, I know, and I would love to hear them.
Well, so I think I was a senior in college when the Anita Hill thing happened, and I think I might have been the only person on the Stanford campus who publicly defended now Justice Thomas in the Stanford newspaper. What is more dangerous? I mean, there's so many levels of danger here. I just think we should recognize, I mean, false accusations, dangerous. Just life, reputation ruining accusations, horrible. What does it do to the judiciary, not just the judiciary, all of the confirmation process if people are afraid that someone might make stuff up about them? And I think this stuff is made up. But Megan, you said, what's more dangerous? I mean, more dangerous is what's happening right now. And I do think we should probably get into the questions about court reform and whether we should have term limits, but these people's lives are being made a living hell, and they're afraid for their lives. They're afraid they can't drive their kids to school without an armed guard. They can't go to church without an armed guard, without people packing in the church. And I think that is dangerous. It's very, very bad. And I think what James mentions is the straight line. Once we just decide it's all nonsense and it's just all politics, then people have to go to church with armed guards and they can't take their kids to school when they're not in an armored vehicle. And that is awful for the people that have to do these jobs, and it's going to deter other people from doing them in the future.
And I think, you know, if you also imagine what would have happened if Kavanaugh had been killed.
Biden would have replaced him as fast as he possibly could with a liberal nominee. And then more of them would have gotten killed.
And then, right, this is the other danger, right? What does this do to the larger, I take the point about the fact who wants to do this job. It's terrible. You have to spend your whole life not saying anything so that you can get the job. And then you have to spend the rest of your life hiding in your house so that you can keep it. Jay, what thoughts do you have? You were looking very active over there.
Was I?
In a good way.
That's how I got my A minuses in law school, by looking active. So, you know, I see this from kind of the outside looking in. First, there are attacks on judges from both sides. President Trump goes after every single judge and goes after them personally. And I think it's totally fair to say, look, there are political prosecutions going on, but that's different from saying, you know, I think one of the first cases when he was president was, this judge is Hispanic, so is going to be against me. That's not a helpful thing. There has been violence against the left, too, by people, you know, who kind of get all ginned up by all this. So to me, and I'm happy to be told I'm wrong about this, the thing that really undermines the credibility of the courts are the ethics attacks. So saying Kavanaugh is a bad person, that gets everyone energized and he shouldn't be on the court, but it doesn't actually go after his judicial philosophy. It just makes the left not like him. When you say Justice Thomas, when you suggest, and it's more than a suggestion, that he's being paid off because he goes on trips with people, that attacks the credibility of the court. Where I struggle with that is the people attacking Justice Thomas are, you know, are politicians, especially on the left, who, I don't know if anyone knows about this, but they have a way of grabbing some money and, you know, insider trading and all of this stuff. And to me, it's all just complete nonsense. And if someone wanted to do like real reform throughout all the branches of government, that's fine. I actually think with the courts, it should not be the legislative body or the executive branch. I think the court has to be able to police itself. But there's a great part of that, which is whatever people think about a specific court, the justices really do have a deep interest in maintaining its own credibility. So the idea that Justice Roberts isn't going to care about ethics issues at all, and Congress needs to come and start doing things, I think is wrong. And I think it's true on the left too. If the left had the majority, I think that they also would take seriously issues around policing themselves.
So I guess part of the question is, with the level of partisanship, now my understanding is, again, from the outside, that the leaks have actually in some ways been the most poisonous thing, that now no one that there is more of a, you know, no one's going to the opera together anymore. Now it is, they don't trust their colleagues because someone inside the court is leaking and they don't necessarily know who, although I believe they suspect they know who, but they don't know. And that makes it harder, right? All of these things that we're talking about with the legitimacy of the court, fundamentally, they are questions of trust. They are questions of living in a high trust society with high trust institutions. And, you know, the argument for attacking the court in order to reform it is that, you know, we need to point out their flaws and then, you know, they'll be fixed, it'll be a better court. But is there a way in which this actually undermines your ability to fix the court? Because everything is now so poisonous that even getting that level of trust to come together and make an ethics code that we're all going to abide by and we can all agree on. What do we do about that problem? How do we start rebuilding both trust in the institution and trust of the institution?
Yeah, so I mean, I think a critical step is going to be having the political branches, particularly the executive branch, stop pushing on the court as hard as the current administration has done. And the most obvious example of this is the dual indictments in two places of the former president and current, potentially future president, and certainly challenger to the current president. One of the two indictments, the one in DC, is a very aggressive legal theory. And that has been pushed hard, it has been pushed fast. The notion that Jack Smith is independent from the president is ridiculous to anyone who's worked at the Justice Department and knows how this works. And the entire time, and Jack Smith has gone up to the court, he's asked the court to resolve things on a transparently political timetable. And when the court did so on a very quick timetable in a way that he didn't like, no less than the President of the United States went out to condemn it in front of national television for not letting him imprison his opponent. That sort of stuff is really, really destabilizing. It has never happened in this country before. It's the kind of thing that happens in other countries, and I fear that if the election goes a certain way, it's just going to get worse. Brian Fallon, who some people in here have heard of, was one of the founders of Demand Justice, which was the first dark money group to start really spending serious money trying to destroy the court. He's a senior advisor to the vice president right now. Presumably he'll be in the White House, and they're going to continue. And so I don't know how you're going to be able to rebuild the institution when you have serious political actors doing everything they can to destroy it.
Well, if I can... If I can channel my inner court critic NJ for a moment. I mean, you do have this problem of if Trump is elected, he absolutely will shamelessly attack judges who defy him.
Saying that guy's a bozo is different, I think, than going after
the
bozo.
I would argue no, but I think he does. He argues that they are illegitimately biased against him, that the court is... And look, I am a critic of the New York cases. I have been dragged by every liberal law professor on Twitter now because I look at the New York cases and I just think... Yeah, this kind of looks like you're prosecuting your political opponents. I'm sorry. But the other side of that is that Trump would say that even if that weren't true.
He says a lot of things.
Yeah, so first, we all remember that Trump was saying lock her up, which was the first time I've seen in kind of political history where a presidential candidate was saying that. And I understand that, you know, he said a lot of things and he didn't do anything and all of that. But that was not a great moment in our history. I'm very concerned about the criminal charges against Trump, especially the state ones, mostly for procedural reasons, which is that the country is very fractured. And if we have a system where the different states or district attorneys can pick a very conservative or very liberal venue, and then say anything about a former president, you can always say someone, I don't know, lied about their taxes or did, these are all successful people who are involved in so many things. And you know, I think what we've learned so far about the Trump prosecutions is that half the country is going to vote to convict or vote that he's liable regardless of the facts, and half will do the opposite. And that's a really bad thing to have in this country. So I agree. I come out at the point of he did not shoot someone. If he shot someone, that's a different type of thing. A lot of the things that he's alleged to have done were things that were in the past, which no one cared about at the time because he was just a businessman. But now we're going to say he cheated the banks, and we're going to go after him. For that, I think that is just we're on a really bad path, and I don't know what the exit ramp is for that.
Just briefly, the lock her up thing was definitely the chant, but then of course as soon as he won the election, he said I'm going to let this go. It's bygones be bygones. We're not going to do anything, and the reward he got was the ambush that Comey and others laid for me and other people in the beginning of the administration. I just think there's we talk a lot about norms and democracy. I think there is a fundamental difference between the former, maybe future president tweeting about some judge being a bozo, as Nicole said, and a sustained multi-year campaign involving the president, the legislature, and millions of dollars in political attacks to destroy an institution systematically and methodically. That is 1,000 times more dangerous than anything that Trump has ever done vis-a-vis the court system, and I think ever would do, if only because that level of organization would be quite difficult.
Nicole, I cut you off, so can I bring you in here?
No, I think to your point about, so we should disentangle critiques about opinions we don't like from critiques that are really fundamentally seeking to undermine individual judges, justices, the integrity of the court. So you know, the tax and Justice Thomas having rich friends. I mean, okay. So, like, you can't have a quid pro quo if there's no quo. It's just like this constant attack against things that if you, like, you scratch the surface, it's actually not about the integrity of the court. It's just a bad look. And so I just think we should think about that when we're talking about these attacks on the court. And it's not, I agree about the lawfare and it's really bad, but I do feel like, and I don't like the arguments about, well, Breyer went on private planes too.
He really went on a lot of private
planes. He went on a lot of private planes. I just
how do I get that job? I would like to go.
The confirmation process
is important. I'm an academic, so I get a lot of boondoggles myself, but I just feel like if we're just the constant personal attacks are really problematic, especially they're unfounded and problematic, and we need to recognize that.
Remember, Justice Thomas, what we were first led to believe was that he wasn't a deep thinker, that he wasn't original, he just followed Scalia, right? This was at the beginning. And then he started with these dissents and concurrences, which have now become the law. And it's, I don't agree with a lot of what he says, but it's hard to say he's not principled. And it's hard to believe that him going on some sort of trip is going to change what is a very kind of well thought out and established, you know, judicial view of how to interpret the Constitution, the statutes, and all of that. So that's my take, at least.
So let me ask the annoying question that every journalist hates, because you've gotten to the end and you've described this amazing, you've described the problem really well, and then people are like, okay, and what do you do? And let me specifically ask a problem, because we're at the Federalist Society. You know, in any marriage, and I think of, I sat next to a divorce lawyer on a plane in 2015, the story is going somewhere, I promise. And he said, we got to talking, and he said, America is like my clients who are in the really bad place where they're just at the point where they're like, oh, yeah, I will total his Porsche. It'll cost me $50,000, but he'll be even more unhappy than me. And the problem is that there's no way for a country to get a divorce. And if you're in that position, if you're married, you know, maybe you think your spouse is 100% wrong, but you're going to have to fix the problem together. So how do we think about, you know, we can say, stop, I agree. In many cases, yes, stop attacking the court, stop with the personal attacks, stop trying to undermine legitimacy. You will miss it when it's gone. But, like, what could we in this room do that would make this problem better other than shouting at the people who are doing it, stop?
So I guess I have two thoughts. I mean, to me, the best reaction to what happened to then-Judge Kavanaugh was that he became Justice Kavanaugh, and the Republicans picked up seats in the Senate. So you pull that, you know, you lose ground, and that's good. Now, obviously, they haven't learned their lesson yet, and so maybe there needs to be more of that. The other thing I think people in this room have an obligation to do, actually, is to actually speak out about this stuff on a as much as possible, and do as much as you can to try to defend the institution, because it can't defend itself. You know, they don't have press secretaries. There's like a little communications office that reports to the chief and is not, believe me, equipped to deal with this level of personal attack on individual justices. And so it's our job as practitioners, and not just the people here, to talk to our friends that are nonpartisan, that are liberal, people like Jay, who I'm, you know, thanks for coming to do this. It's great to have you here. I mean, that's awesome. To say that this is nuts. I mean, if you destroy the rule of law, you're not going to have a country anymore, and things are not going to work for anybody, including the people who are sponsoring the attacks. That's my take.
So I'll just be the egghead here as a person who teaches the law. When I teach the law, I just try to teach the law. I really just try to teach my students that there are sides. You know, one of the most disappointing things that I've read about law professors saying, oh, I just can't teach the law anymore. It's not real, and I feel triggered. I feel
that's only
like,
at Georgetown.
No, it's everywhere. There's like New York Times articles about how I can't talk about constitutional law anymore because I just feel so triggered. I just teach the law. So you say there was this rule, there was that rule, and there was like this method, and there's that method, and what's the best method? I think the best thing we can do, as lawyers, and as a law professor in particular, is try to just be rigorous in how we approach the law, recognize the diversity of approaches to the law, and understand that the people, the justices, who are applying the methodologies that I like, are doing it with, like, ethically, rigorously, honestly. And then if you don't like it, say, I would prefer a different methodology. But as a professor, I try to understand my job is to just be a lawyer teaching law. And I worry that, especially in the legal academy, that is just too rare.
I'd never heard of the fragility of law students, so that's an interesting concept.
I'm not the fragility of law professors. My students are quite not fragile.
Really? Okay. Well, that's
maybe
unique.
So, that's just Notre Dame.
So I definitely think that conversations are the only way through. But I think what's really important is for people who disagree with the outcome of a case. So I was not pumped about Dobbs. I think it's really important for those people to speak out in a way of saying, it's not a crazy decision. Policy-wise, didn't like it. Happy to talk about reliance interests in the decision and why I disagree with that. But to start with a structure of, come on, Roe v. Wade was not the tightest opinion out there. And and we can say that without the virtue signaling. Like, I'm sure people, is this being recorded?
I probably is.
Great. So I'll get a lot of nasty emails saying, like, you know, I'm not for women's rights, all those things. And it's missing the point, which is that if you actually do believe in these issues, you also can believe in the rule of law, and you can talk about them more intellectually, and you can actually give up some ground and be honest about it. I think that's the best way to do it. It's really the losing side who has to be the one who's making the strongest case for it's still good we've got a Supreme Court that is making decisions, is writing it out in a reasoned way, and then we can discuss it. But it really is the obligation of the losing side more than the winning side.
Afterwards, I really want to ask you how you can have a longer than 9-month reliance interest on an abortion. But I will not derail.
Because people move to states, and I don't know. Because Dobbs is bad, okay?
It's the neutral position, as Justice Kavanaugh explained.
let me ask about that, because one thing, and I will say this is for journalism, that I was in an editorial meeting right before the pandemic, and I was talking about, you know, how, like, young conservative and liberal journalists will drink together, and the actually young liberal journalists in the room looked at me like I had just suddenly sprouted another head. They had no idea what I was talking about. And I had moved to Washington in 2007 and done this, and there had been, in fact, you know, things got a little testy during Obamacare, so we had to cede our wedding so that the liberals and the conservatives were not next to each other, but still, people were cordial, they went to weddings together, and it seems like that doesn't happen anymore. And my understanding is that that also doesn't maybe happen so much now with lawyers either. Am I right about that? And then, if I am right about that, how do you even have those conversations?
I'll go drinking with you anytime you want. I've only been back in private practice for a couple of years. When you're in the government, you tend to hang out with people from your team, as it were, just because those are who your friends are. I don't know. I think the private bar is relatively bipartisan still. I think the bigger issue is that there's what seems to me a much greater fear than there was 25 or 30 years ago about speaking out on these issues. And so people at large law firms who you would think of as sort of deans of the bar are not doing what they would have done in the 80s and probably did for Earl Warren, I haven't checked, which is say this is not okay. And we're not going to destroy this institution because you're unhappy about a particular outcome. And I do think that would be important in addition to going out and drinking together on a regular basis.
Is that, can I ask?
I mean, I walk through the Notre Dame at Commons. Notre Dame Law School students will know this every day, because it's like a warm cut. It gets cold at Notre Dame, and you got to walk through the warm cut. And I see lots of law students sitting together having conversations across ideological divides, and I think that's great. So maybe I live in Disneyland, but I think that's what we need.
I personally find it a lot more interesting to talk to people who experience the world differently than me. That's why I like speaking at these events, that it's, you know, different language, different viewpoints. But I don't really agree that there's a lot of discussion going on. So, I mean, I'm a plaintiff's attorney, and plaintiff's attorneys, you know, want to have this pack mentality, and anyone who's not a plaintiff's attorney is bad. And I basically stopped speaking at the plaintiff's attorney's conferences because it's just hell. It's just sorry, am I allowed to say that?
Sorry. You'll be blessed later.
It's not terribly interesting when everyone's just saying the same exact thing. And when you actually get into substantive discussions, you realize that people actually have a lot more commonality. But your question is, how do you foster those substantive discussions? And I don't know, you're the law professor.
I mean, I do think the Federalist Society historically has been very good at fostering those discussions, like we are right now, where we've got sort of a diversity on the panel of viewpoints and backgrounds. And that's a critical role for this organization to continue playing, I think.
Would it help if the court cleaned up its Ethics Act? Would it help if they promulgated a really tight new code?
Yeah,
or
I mean,
would it just be fodder for the war?
So I reject the premise that there's an ethical problem that they need to solve. I clerk there, I know some of them pretty well, and these are about the most cautious and prudent people you're ever going to encounter in real life. And so the idea that they're just like running around partying all the time on private jets or whatever,
Not all the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes they write opinions.
You know, I think like Justice Barrett's like having dinner with Jesse at her house most nights, but it's just silly. And so, no, I mean, I think, look, they've now said they're going to abide by the code that they've issued. I think doing anything more than that is just going to become grist for the mill. This idea that they're going to have the lower courts enforce it is a ridiculous idea. I've written about that, and it would not work. And it would upend the judiciary. And so, no, I mean, I don't think they need to go further in the face of this bullying. Now, if Congress wants to pass an all-of-government rule that's going to apply to them and is going to apply equally, and it also perhaps includes Nancy Pelosi's stock portfolio, I think that's a conversation we could have.
The problem with all of this is just these gotcha moments, right? I mean, it's impossible to apply evenly. There's always the chance, like maybe Justice Barrett ate 3 shrimp at the tailgate instead of Jesse ate 5 shrimp. I mean,
he had probably
20 shrimp at the tailgate. But it was a shrimp boil tailgate from New Orleans. But I mean, the problem with all of these codes is about disclosure, and it's just inviting these gotcha moments and. You know, it's inviting unfair and unequal like exposures of these things, and I don't know the answer, Megan. I really don't, because I don't think that we should. I'm not against ethics. I am against gotcha moments.
Well, let me suggest a couple things that could perhaps fix things, break things further. Who knows? One is the obvious, right? Doing court reform. Setting term limits. Why is this a bad idea if...
It's sort of unconstitutional.
Assume we do a constitutional amendment, because that will definitely happen.
Well, then we can have a different conversation.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, would it be a good idea if we did a constitutional amendment?
Well, it depends on what thing we're talking about, but I mean...
18-year term limits, staggered so that each president gets 2...
There's like a very fundamental difference between a prospective 18-year term thing that applies to future justices and the current proposal, which applies to current justices. So it's really just the Alito Thomas Roberts Removal Act that we are currently talking about. I think things like that, or court packing, court expanding, I mean, they're just so goofy that all they're going to do is destroy the credibility of the institution on a prospective basis, because then the other side is going to come back and come up with their own thing, with the Jackson-Kagan Term Limit Act, and it's just going to be a race to the bottom, and the ultimate consequence is going to be that the political branches do not listen to the court anymore. I mean, I worked in the executive branch. We have a president right now who very much wants to do things, like forgive student loan debt and put his opponent in prison. It is not hard to imagine a president who tells the court he does not care about their opinion, which, by the way, is how it works in most countries. Now, if that's the country we want to live in, fine. But I think the people that think that's going to be okay need to think awfully hard about what a President DeSantis or someone like that's going to look like if we don't have the court there to set the limits. I might think it's great, but the people who are pushing the stuff right now, I don't think would find that very enjoyable.
If the Constitution were set up where there were 18-year terms or something, you know, maybe. I mean, we could find a lot of fault of that, too, because then after the 18 years, the justices are going to cash in and they're going to take these expensive, you know, these high-paying jobs. And no, yeah, hopefully. That would be great.
Even
I'm all
worse.
For that. We're doing the Lord's work.
God bless you.
But yeah, I mean, all this stuff about, like, you know, let's change all the rules is very short-sighted because, you know, we've got a Democratic president now, and then we won't, and then at some point the Republicans will have all three branches of the government, and this is where Democrats, and I'm speaking as one, sometimes struggle of understanding what the repercussions are going to be, but it's a disaster. You add a few more justices, and then the Republicans are going to do something else.
Well, I look forward to it as an example of exponential growth, where you know you just keep doubling the size of the court every time the presidency turns over, and eventually it's like everyone in the United States is a Supreme Court justice. Right.
It's like the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah.
So here is the other solution to which I am somewhat more partial, which is like, are we asking courts to do too much? Are we asking it to be a kind of super legislature that tries to resolve every hard problem? And I think that Roe was an example of that, right? This is a hard problem, we'll take care of that, now you can't talk about it anymore. And that it didn't resolve the problem. And I will say with cases that I was sympathetic to, like Heller, I'm very sympathetic. I actually agree with the reading of the Second Amendment. I also worry that by putting these problems politically off limits, that with some of the free speech cases, which again, I agree with as an intellectual matter, but that by putting things like campaign finance reform politically off limits, that you're creating a situation where these sorts of attacks are inevitable. Because control of the court matters so much because the court keeps telling, gets to tell the side it doesn't agree with, or the side that, you know, that it is less sympathetic to, let us say. Gets to tell them that they can't do a bunch of stuff and that they're not even allowed to try to handle it politically.
But don't you think, Megan, that the problem starts a long time before Heller? I mean,
yes.
The court
absolutely.
Has...
Absolutely.
So if you want to be Burkean or whatever, like, you want to say, oh, the court should just defer far more to the political democratic process, okay. But we're going to have to go back a long way to the 50s, the 60s. I mean, to say the court has usurped for itself this power.
Yes, I agree.
And it has made up a lot of stuff. So some of the stuff just needs to be unmade up. And then we can go back to democracy.
So can we like lay out a blueprint? Well, we're undoing all of these, and then we'll be done.
But,
and you can
but
have
Megan,
it back.
Like that's why this is also sort of like Alice in Wonderland like. I mean, all Dobbs did was take the court out of abortion.
Exactly.
And so, like, the idea that Dobbs was some power grab by the judiciary is totally crazy. They said, we're not going to be involved in this. You guys go figure it out. And what do you know? Many states have much more permissive abortion laws than they did before Dobbs. And some states have less. And that's, you know, like, how the democratic process works.
I should say I favored Dobbs. I favored whatever it was going to be. I didn't know the name of it when I was writing
but that
overturned Roe. No, for this exact reason.
Yeah.
Because it was the government taking something out of the, it was a court taking something out of the political process, and instead of resolving the issue, it had made it completely toxic. And I actually think what is happening now with all of its errors and contentions and everything else is the healthy process of communities handling a really hard problem on their own. I don't want to see Congress come in and make a national abortion law, or the courts say that there, you know, there's a, for, you have a, is it a due process right to not? I don't want.
I don't think that's going to happen for a while.
Right. I don't want the courts in it at all, precisely because I think putting these things off limits ends up in this place where the Senate and the presidency are increasingly, you're just you're just voting for who's going to give you the justices you want, and then the justices give you what you want without you having to go through the democratic process. And it seems very unhealthy to me, but I'm also not a lawyer, and it's probably extremely naive.
I think Alito's done with us.
Actually, I just wanted to note that it is important to have a little bit of Q&A, so we should probably go
to
some Q&A.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Everyone has been too interesting. Can we turn to the, and of course I like to hear myself talk because I'm a journalist. Can we turn to the audience and get some questions? I'm sorry. I should have gone to Q&A.
Okay. So I was a committee counsel for 14 years for Congress, and my view is there's usually a motive for things, and my sense is that the motive is very simple. There are many, many interest groups across the progressive spectrum who don't like the court, and the solution is to expand the number of justices and create a majority. The problem is the public doesn't like it, so you destroy the reputation of the court and you set it up so that when you get a majority, you can pack the court. So in answer to your question, I want your thoughts of, you said, how do we stop this? And the answer is we take away the option for politicians to pack the court. And most people in this room probably know that there's a constitutional amendment called the Keep Nine Amendment, which would say the Supreme Court is nine justices. 200 members of Congress support it. And my question to each of the panelists is, do you think that it would be a good idea to amend the Constitution, to put into the Constitution that the Supreme Court of the United States shall be composed of nine justices so there wouldn't be an incentive to destroy the reputation of the court to pack it?
Yes.
I guess so.
It's not going to happen.
Nine isn't a magic number, but I guess so. I mean, I haven't thought that much about it, but yeah.
I'm just going to go with yes.
I'm with him.
All right, next question.
J.P.
And by
Hogan.
The way, we can't see you at all because these lights are blinding.
Okay.
So
J.P. Hogan, I've been writing on politics over 30 years. In 2007, I started writing full-time to defeat Hillary. But anyhow, you're talking about this. One thing you should bring up is Bill Clinton's post-constitution. If you study what they were meaning by post-constitution, they were basically voiding our protections from tyranny to make some changes. And when you start factoring that in, a lot of this against the court is things that the Clintons did that haven't been checked, and then it really gets complicated because Mueller was that would have been covering up for them after 9/11 on ways that...
Sorry, is there a question here?
The question is... taking apart the Clintons' post-constitution, if you study it, and you study it as they were actually trying to avoid tyranny, our protection from tyranny, and what Trump ran into when he let Hillary go after Lock Her Up. You can go to lockherup.biz, I was writing a rap on the Constitution before Hamilton. But taking apart the Clintons, you answer a lot of your questions.
Thank you. Due to my irresponsibility with the Q&A, we have gone too long, so does anyone
want to
comment on that? I'm
going to
move to the next questioner.
Yeah, hi, panel. I think we've seen with, I think it was mentioned on the panel about these gotcha moments that politicians are so often seeking out with these confirmation hearings. What is the panel's opinion on these confirmation hearings going behind closed doors and whether that would solve things a little bit, by taking away the gotcha moments like asking Justice Jackson what is a woman and things like that, yeah?
That's a really good question.
I don't know why that's a gotcha moment, though. And I'm glad you asked that question because sometimes I'm worried that there's too much of a focus on the Supreme Court when, district court judges and the appellate judges have an incredible amount of influence, too. And what we're seeing with the confirmation process is that it's a lot of kind of subtle virtue signaling and not a lot of substance. My favorite senator, who I disagree with politically when it comes to confirmation hearings, is Senator Kennedy, because he asked trial judges, questions like, do you know what a motion in limine is? And that matters to me. I'm in front of district judges. And what do I want first? I actually don't care if they're conservative or liberal. I care that they're efficient, that they're smart, that they're paying attention to law, and that they're decisive. I just needed to say that, so I used your question as an opportunity to say that.
Sure.
Now
yeah.
I want to answer it directly. I still think it should be out in the public. I think that's a better way. It's part of democracy. I just wish that it shifted to something more substantive, and we've gotten so far away from that.
For what it's worth, there is a second secret hearing where they talk about the background investigation that the FBI does. That is supposed to be where they ask you about, you know, whatever, you got arrested when you were 21 or you have a traffic. You know, that has historically been where these sort of very personal issues that bear on your fitness are ventilated for precisely the reason you suggest, which is that historically we have not wanted to destroy people's lives for having the temerity to want to serve their country. And I think that is a good process, and that the public hearing should be about judicial philosophy, the role of the courts, and all of that.
Yep.
Thank you. Okay, next question.
Several of you complained about the media printing falsehoods about the courts and judges. Would a solution be to overrule New York Times versus Sullivan and hold them to account?
No! We're moving on to the next question.
Can I?
No, I will let that.
It is so, very ahistorical.
It is. I agree completely with Nicole about that, but I'll just offer one counterpoint. I tend to worry that that would have an asymmetric effect on the few media outlets that are still sympathetic to the way that we think about the world, like Fox is headquartered in New York. And so I tend to worry that we would just end up shooting ourselves in the head rather than getting Megan's less scrupulous colleagues.
I beg your pardon. Yes. We are a fantastic value at only $50 a year, I might add.
I think I use my neighbor's subscription.
Sir, you make me sad. All right, do we have... Last question.
This has been a great conversation about the Supreme Court. I want to ask about district courts and circuit courts because they have even less of a defense apparatus around them. You have third-party groups fighting to recuse district court judges on all kinds of things. You have the government coming in arguing that all these cases actually need to be decided in D.C. by the D.C. Circuit. So the attacks are not limited to the Supreme Court. And in fact, you know, district courts have even more incentive to just say, fine, let somebody else deal with this because they can just send it to another judge, whereas the Supreme Court actually has to decide the case. What can be done there? How can we help bulk up the district court judges and the circuit court judges? And
I don't have any particular. I will say the Supreme Court doesn't seem super much motivated to decide a lot of cases these days. But I agree with you that there is that the court attacks go below the Supreme Court.
Tyler, for what it's worth, that is a new thing. This administration has been much more willing to attack the district court judges, raise venue, accuse plaintiffs of forum shopping than certainly our administration did. And it's some of my former colleagues that are doing it. And I don't know where that comes from and if it's just a decision to be more adversarial to a out-of-control judiciary. But that's the kind of stuff that I think is very destabilizing. Like, the Justice Department didn't used to do stuff like that. And it is very much inconsistent with the norms that historically governed it. So, I don't know. I mean, I think they need to stop. One way to get them to stop would be for some people in this room to take over the Justice Department. Peacefully.
I would suggest that forum shopping is not a new thing, and it's not just with the government. So, you know, corporations, I know, yay corporations.
No, we don't like them anymore.
Oh, either. You don't?
Yeah. No, yeah. That's the next panel.
Good. So, yeah. So Facebook, who we all don't like, right?
Yeah.
Good. Facebook, you know, puts, if you're going to sue Facebook in their contract of adhesion, you're going to do it in the Northern District of California. Awful decision by them because Northern District of California hates Facebook, but that was their decision. Plaintiffs' attorneys try to find the best venue for themselves. What I've noticed in my practice is district judges, the good ones especially, and everyone I go in front of is one of the good ones, they're not really terribly interested in a lot of gamesmanship, and I don't find that what's pulling at them is to not do work and send it to a different judge. So I understand the thrust of the question. I'm not seeing that, at least in my civil practice, in a way that's terribly concerning to me.
Well, thank you to our amazing panelists.
Thanks,
thank you so much.